A small dueling pistol, maybe. Delouche eyed him for a moment, and then gave a nod. All right, he said, gesturing to a door off the kitchen. Let's see it then, He followed Gaston into the dim storeroom and left the door open. Gaston reached into his bag and brought out the bundle that held the quad iron, pushing aside a pouch of mechanical parts for the pocket watch he was repairing. Delouche didn't trade in that sort of thing. The main thing here was the gun. He set the bundle on top of a crate that held bags of grain and undid the wrappings. In the dim light, the gun seemed to glow softly, and his hand ached for it. Delouche took in a sharp breath with a hiss and stepped back, an expression of horror on his pale face. How did you... But no. No, Gaston, I can't take this. It's trouble sure as you stand here. I know it's big, Delouche. Why do you think I came to you? You know firearms better than anyone in the city. Just hold it, feel its balance, and... The thin man was shaking his head and holding up both palms as though to push away the gun and Gaston both. No, truly I can't. It's rune inscribed. That's a whole different market, Gaston noticed he was beginning to sweat as he continued. A gun like that, it stands out, gets a man noticed. There would be questions. No, it would be too hard, impossible. He took a grimy handkerchief from his coat pocket with a shaking hand and began to wipe it across his forehead. Fine, Gaston said, shrugging. Maybe you're not the man for the job after all. Or maybe I should just keep it. Could come in handy. He began rewrapping the gun in the cloth. Delouche was across the small room in a second, his grip tight on Gaston's arm. Will you listen to me, That gun is evil. Get rid of it however you can if you know what's good for you. Throw it in the river if you have to, but get rid of it. He dropped his arm, cast a final glance toward the gun, shuddered and hurried out of the storeroom. Gaston stared after him, unsure what to think of the man's words. He'd known Delouche and his wife for years, and he'd never seen so much as a hint of superstition in them. Maybe she's sicker than I thought. He's just taking out his worry on me. He finished wrapping the gun and shoved the bundle in his bag, his mind racing. Sure, a gun like this could draw attention if you didn't keep it hidden, but evil? People were evil, not things. He'd seen plenty proof of that. Hearing the cook fussing at a serving girl in the kitchen, he paused. When the voices faded as the cook followed the girl out of the room, he came out of the storeroom, never one to miss a chance at a meal. He glanced longingly at the stew pot, but instead grabbed a loaf of bread and a cold turkey leg without missing a step. He was out the back door and on his way before the cook returned. When the hooded woman slipped cautiously into the unassuming shop, the tinker was working at a side table, his head down and an expression of intense concentration on his face. I'll be right with you, he said without looking up. Just let me finish this one thing.
I'm afraid I don't have long, said the woman.
He looked up immediately and jumped to his feet, flushing pink. Oh, excuse me. My apologies. She waved away his concern.
No, no, Cloutier, you have your job to do just as I have mine.
Yes, I suppose I do. I mean... He stopped himself and wrung his hands. Well, what can I help you with today, madam? He looked at her questioningly as he limped out from behind his work table.
Call me Marie, please.
She paused and he nodded.
I have a job to discuss with you. It's a little more involved than your usual work. Probably best discussed privately?
The tinker flushed pink again. But of course, Marie, please, this way. He limped to a side room and held the door for her. She followed, taking in the layout and furnishings in a glance. While he set the water to boil and prepared tea, the tinker told her the news of the last few months. She listened quietly, her hood now back and her face lined with worry. She'd hoped at least some of the stories she'd heard from other travelers were exaggerations, and life was not truly so difficult in Meriwen. But the Cadorans had turned all the city's heavy industry toward outfitting their war efforts and repairing their great machines, and the people were suffering. The winter had been particularly difficult. There was little grain, and even less meat to be had. She shook her head as Cloutier related the number of citizens jailed or worse for petty crimes, carrying an unauthorized weapon, stealing food, or simply sleeping in an abandoned building. With tens of thousands of northern soldiers moving through the city to the front line as well as other parts of occupied Lale, security was tighter than ever. She considered the military implications of all those enemy soldiers being added to the field and wondered what offensive they were preparing for.
"I'm afraid people are getting used to this way of life,"
Cloutier said, looking sadly into his weak tea.
"It has all become normal,"
the woman said.
"No, I think not. The heart of our people is strong, Cloutier. They will do what they must, but they will never allow the boots of the Cadoran interlopers to crush their spirit or their dreams. Never."
He looked up at the conviction in her words, a spark of hope evident in his eyes.
"Of course not,"
he said, as if he had just remembered the truth. He lifted his cup.
"To a free Lale,"
she smiled.
"To a free Lale," she replied,
raising her cup to his,
"whatever the price."
She took a drink and set down the cup.
"Now, about the job. I have a machine, very old but in good condition, that requires some new parts. I'd like you to make them for me. Get it back in working order."
Cloutier blinked.
"Of course, I would be happy to try," he said. "But wouldn't you do better with a machinist or a mechanic? My experience in fabrication is limited, like my resources."
He pointed his chin at the main room of the shop. The woman shook her head.
"I have a mechanic, but I'm afraid this is beyond her expertise. I have run into some difficulty acquiring the parts she needs. What I do have are specifications for them."
She looked directly at the tinker.
"They are within your ability, I know it. I have seen you work wonders before."
"Ah, yes," he chuckled, a misty look in his eyes. "Once I worked wonders almost daily, as I recall."
He sighed and patted the knee of his injured leg.
"Ah, but those days are long gone, my lady.
Begging your pardon, but I am not the man I once was."
"I am not the man you need for this."
"Begging your pardon, but I know better. Will you try at least?"
The tinker blinked again, and then he smiled.
"As always, my Marie, I am at your service. I will do my best."
The woman smiled as she laid a hand on his arm.
"What more can anyone give?"
She sat back in her chair.
"I saw a young man in the market today I'm curious about."
She described the pickpocket, and Cloutier made a face.
"I know who you mean. Gaston Cross. He grew up on the streets, an alley rat who took up thieving to survive. He's quick and clever enough, but he wallows in his anger at the occupation and at the former government both."
"That's understandable," the woman said. "A young man like that might do well for the resistance, don't you think?"
Cloutier scoffed. "Not that one. He's a loner and stubborn. He's been approached by recruiters before, but he always sends them away, saying they're no better than the Cadorans."
His face twisted into a scowl of disgust.
"He's too selfish to be a patriot. He is too selfish to be anything but a street thief."
The woman nodded. Some people needed to hear arguments put to them in just the right way, and a boy who'd grown up on the streets was bound to be more suspicious than most. This particular young man, though, had far more in his future than he could have ever imagined. She just hoped he'd realize it while he still had a future.
Late Spring, 607 AR.
Gaston sat with crossed arms. "Why are you talking to me? Plenty of people could have wrecked that building." In front of him paced Reynard Enzo, captain of the city guard in Meriwen, and a man well known to Gaston from years of conversations just like this one in the cramped city guard office. Captain Enzo sighed.
"Perhaps. But there was no sign of the resistance there, and this incident has your name all over it. You don't think I can recognize your handiwork?
The Wandering Bear is a prominent hall, but not heavily guarded. Not officially, anyway. Owned by a wealthy former council member and popular with the Kaedorans, and that chandelier was just installed.
Sounds like someone did the city a favor, said Gaston.
Enzo had always looked out for him, had given him chance after chance, rather than just throwing him in jail or leaving him to the filthy Reds, but he still wasn't going to confess to destroying property. The chandelier must have cost a small fortune, if not a big one. That was the whole point. The captain stopped pacing and looked at him sharply.
Listen to me, Gaston, he said, his voice earnest. This isn't just stealing a few coins. Messing with the Kaedorans, that's dangerous territory. I don't know how you did it, but I know you were involved.
Gaston started to object, but Enzo silenced him with a gesture.
Maybe you've gotten mixed up with a gang. Maybe you made it look like the chandelier's chains were shot to throw off the investigation. It doesn't really matter. I know you, and I know how you think. Haven't I always been good to you? Haven't I always protected you?
Gaston uncrossed his arms. That shot had felt amazing. He'd planned to get close and shoot up the place, all right, but once he was at the window, he'd decided to just try for the chain. He'd taken his time with the shot and visioned the bullet slicing through the chain perfectly and then fired. And it had happened just the way he'd imagined. The chain snapped and the chandelier crashed into pieces on the floor below.
Spectacular.
That's not the point, he said.
No, but it is important because I need you to understand. You go much further and I won't be able to protect you. It'll be out of my hands. What happens to you, what happens to your neighbors, what happens to Meriwen because of you, all out of my hands.
He rubbed at the bridge of his nose with a finger and thumb, then sat next to Gaston before continuing.
You might think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. Gaston, the Kaedorans mean to stay here, and they'll go to any lengths to prove it to us. If we want to survive, we have to work with them, not against them. If they catch you doing something like this,
he waved his hand toward the report on his desk,
they'll kill you. These little pranks, are they really worth your life? You could do so much better.
Gaston bridled at this. You won't choose to protect me, you mean? You couldn't stand up to the nobles that were bleeding the life out of Meriwen, and you won't stand up to the invaders who swept in to leave their stench all over the country. You don't have the spine for it, not even to make your own life less miserable.
Well, I do.
He paused and then added, I'm not a kid anymore, Captain. I can take care of myself. He meant it. He was seeing things more clearly now, just not the way Enzo wanted him to. He couldn't sell the quad iron right now, not with the kind of reaction he'd gotten from Delouche. After a few months, maybe he'd have better luck with someone else. The man wasn't the only one in town with contacts. In the meantime, he could finally make a real difference in his life and get some hits in against the Kaedorans and the wealthy bastards who'd made the country vulnerable to them. Enzo looked at him evenly, his expression sad.
You're wrong, Gaston. I'll protect you as much as I can, but my higher duty is to the people of Meriwen. I shield you far more than you know. I shield all of you. What would happen if I stood up to the Kaedorans? My head would leer at you all from beside the so-called Queen's Gate, alongside all the others. Perhaps the city guard would be allowed to select a new captain, but probably not. The Kaedorans would take the opportunity to fill the post with someone already in their pocket if they didn't simply hand it to one of their own soldiers. He shuddered. I've heard stories about Kaedor that would spoil butter. That they force every last citizen into the military at age 10 and onto the battlefield at 13. That they let their people freeze in order to save coal for their ravenous warjacks. Even that for centuries their rulers have meddled in dark sorcery.
Gaston shook his head. I don't care what they do to their own people. I care what they do to us. Enzo stood wearily and put a hand on Gaston's shoulder.
So do I, Gaston.
They were both silent for a moment, and then the captain simply walked from the room, leaving Gaston to contemplate his next move. Gaston hadn't gone more than a few hundred yards from the city guard office when a young woman appeared beside him, matching her steps to his. In a glance, he took in her dusty, worn breeches and boots, nondescript coat, and long red hair. She looked familiar, but he couldn't place her. She must have noticed his confusion because a satisfied smile flashed across her face, so quickly he almost wondered if he'd imagined it. Without looking at him, she said, "That chandelier was good work." He started. How did she know about that? Morrow, had she seen him? He'd been so careful. He wouldn't rise to the bait. "Do I know you?" he asked. There was that hint of a smile again. "Not exactly, but I've seen you work the market crowd." A red-haired woman ducking behind the farm stand. So that was where he'd seen her before. He said nothing. "You have talent, Gaston Cross. You should put it to work for more than the occasional coin. Put it to work for a free lail. Join the resistance." She shoved the pamphlet toward him. On the front, in a large bold script, were the words, "Restore your nation to its rightful place. Join the Lailese resistance." Gaston almost stumbled. "Is she serious?" he thought. "No, I'm not risking my neck for you people. And for what, a piece of paper that says Lail instead of Cador? Go bother someone else." The woman shrugged. "You didn't strike me as a coward, but maybe you're right. Better to do what the Cadorans want and stay out of their way. Better to live off their scraps than stand up for yourself, if you call that living." "The resistance just wants to bring back the filthy weasels who kicked us around before the northerners got here. Hell, they probably paid for the invasion. I'm not interested," he growled. She was silent for a moment, but Gaston didn't respond. She made him uncomfortable, and he wished she'd go away. Finally, she said, "You'll die like this, you know. You'll die on the street or you'll die in prison, but you can't survive in a place like this alone. At least with the resistance, you'd have some protection."
"The resistance be damned!"
"And spread the word, will you? I already told you people no." He really was in no mood for this.
"Hey, it's all the same to me. But this is your chance to do something, a chance to make a difference."
He grunted. The resistance had nothing to do with him, and he wanted to keep it that way.
"All right, then," the red-haired woman said. "Fine. If you change your mind, look for me in the market."
"And Gaston?" Surprised by the change in her tone, he finally looked at her. Her expression was unreadable, but her next word sent chills down his spine.
"Be careful. We might not be the only ones with eyes on you."
Late summer, 607 AR. Breathing heavily, Gaston darted past the ornate sculpture of Giselle de Lamartine and around the corner and pressed his body flat up against the wall of the Cadoran administration building, keeping his light coat closed. The sound of boots echoed in the street but faded after a moment. The patrol hadn't spotted him. He relaxed, slumping against the building as he caught his breath. That had been close. His pulse pounded in his veins, and he smiled at the thrill of it. Not close enough to catch Gaston Cross, he thought. The past few months had been exhilarating. He'd gone from skulking around the market for copper coins to picking and choosing targets he'd never have dreamed of a year ago. After he'd brought down the fancy new chandelier and the wandering bear, he'd gone out regularly, targeting a whole range of locations for the coin, the destruction, and the thrill of it. Sometimes he used the gun to shoot up a place, sometimes he didn't. At first he told himself he needed the practice, but soon he'd immersed himself in the power of knowing he could go where he wanted, do what he wanted, and neither the Cadorans nor the city guard could stop him. He'd had many close calls, but it seemed like the bolder he became, the luckier he was. With the adrenaline of the chase in his blood, he was faster and more sure-footed than ever, and stories of his daring and elusiveness were flying through the city. When he was in his new element, his weapons became an extension of him,
and he became part of the night itself. He hadn't hurt anyone. So the poor thrilled to the rumors of the shadowy vigilante who stalked the genteel neighborhoods, and the wealthy were aghast at the nerve and skill of the man in the stories. The bastards might not know his name, but they sure as blazes knew his work. Captain Enzo had cornered him more than once for a heart-to-heart, but when Enzo said to lay off for a while, Gaston raided a whole string of nobles' houses in the Rose Quarter. When the captain suggested darkly that those break-ins didn't look like simple robberies, Gaston went on a hunt for vodka barrels being stored for taverns and inns across the city. The conversations with Enzo always went the same way.
"I know it's you," Enzo would say.
"Could have been, or maybe I was across town," Gaston would answer.
"You don't want to stir up trouble," Enzo would say.
"They've never cared about what I wanted before."
"Someone's going to get hurt," Enzo would say.
"It's about time," Gaston would answer. The captain would look at him with worried eyes, and Gaston would bristle just a bit under his gaze. "I can do what I want," he'd think, missing the reassuring weight of the oversized quad iron against his leg. His knives just didn't feel the same. "For once in my life, I can do whatever I want."
Keeping the hood of his long coat up and his face in shadow, Gaston followed the women from a distance. It wasn't difficult, as one or the other stopped frequently. Though they were only reasonably well-dressed, their shoes were very high quality, and their hands looked soft, not red and rough. Not laborers then, but genteel ladies dressed down for a bit of shopping where their coin would go further, at the expense of the hard-working folks whose wares they bought. As one of the two looked over a stand of ribbons and fabric scraps, her companion touched her arm.
"I saw a woodcarver stand a little further down. Meet me there when you're done."
The first woman nodded, and the second stepped into the crowd, her purse swinging from her wrist. Gaston quickened his step. The woman couldn't have set herself up more perfectly. Just as he neared her, a familiar redhead cut between them.
"Georges," she cried with obvious relief, "thank Morrow. I've been looking for you everywhere. Darling, we've been betrayed. If Papa finds you... Oh, Georges, what are we going to do?"
"Darling? Georges?" Gaston blinked, and before he knew it, she was leading him out of the crowd with a firm grip on his arm. He looked back just in time to see a dirty little fleecer dart in to slice the bottom of the shopping woman's purse.
"Damn it," he said.
Several people nearby snickered and tried to look elsewhere.
"Just keep moving,"
the redhead ordered in a whisper as she steered him to the side door of a nondescript shop off the main market. She rapped on the door twice, then twice again.
"What in blazes do you think you're..."
He stopped mid-sentence as the door opened, then she gave him a little shove right into a large wall of flesh with arms.
Two huge hands came down on his shoulders. The door was shut, and he was walked to a table and pushed down into a chair, not ungently, but quite decisively.
"Guns and knives," said the man wall, holding out his plate-sized hand.
Gaston stared at him. The man leaned down so his face was almost even with Gaston's. It wasn't pleasant.
"Give me your gun and your knives," he said slowly, wiggling his fingers.
Gaston pulled his two knives from his belt and handed them over, never looking away from the man's face.
"Now the gun."
Gaston swallowed. "Sorry, I can't do that," he said. "But if it'll make you feel better, I'll promise not to shoot you." The man cocked an eyebrow at him.
"Feeling bold today? That's nice. Now hand over the gun."
I...
Gaston felt his pulse begin to race. A bead of sweat ran down his back.
"How about a compromise?" said a woman's voice. "You hold on to the gun, but you give him the bullets."
Gaston jumped, then turned red as he realized the room wasn't empty beyond himself and his new friend. The voice had come from behind a small plain screen across the small room. "What do you want from me?" he demanded, louder than he intended. He glanced at the man wall, but the brute simply raised an eyebrow at him and held out a meaty hand.
"There's no need for worry. You're perfectly safe here," the woman said.
After a brief pause, Gaston drew the gun and emptied the chambers, then dropped the cartridges into the guard's outstretched hand one by one. Satisfied, the man stepped back and leaned against the wall with a bored expression. The woman continued,
"I understand you're prepared to throw your life away fighting for scraps from the Cadoran table rather than join the Lely's resistance. I don't think that's wise."
Gaston laughed bitterly. "Why would I need to be wise? Smart, quick, and lucky, sure, but wise I can do without, especially when it involves the resistance. All they have to offer me is another way to die." He waited, but there was no reply. He found himself touching the handle of his gun, even though he'd just handed over the ammunition. He was surprised to see a slight figure in a deeply hooded cloak emerge from behind the screen. She took a seat slightly to the side of him.
"I know you think the resistance isn't for you, but you don't have all the facts. The resistance can offer you one thing you can't steal, no matter how good you get. Something far more valuable than gold."
Gaston smirked. "What would that be? Patriotism?
Warcaster training."
She said it just like that, as if she had said he could get a lace for his boot or berries for breakfast. He gaped.
"Warcaster? Are you crazy?"
Beginning to laugh, he said,
Is this a prank? Who put you up to this, bitch?"
He started to get up.
"Please sit down, Gaston. Listen to me," she said in exactly the same even tone as before, but
suddenly he realized the man wall was directly behind his chair.
"Damn, he's fast," Gaston thought.
She went on.
"It may be something of a shock, but yes, you have the Warcaster ability, and I think there's something inside you that recognizes it. Haven't you ever noticed how lucky you are? Everyone is lucky sometimes, but all the time? I bet you don't ever have to think about where to place your feet or how hard to throw a rope, and you never have."
She paused to let it sink in.
"Now, recently, all of that has been even stronger. It's not because of your increased activities. It's your Warcaster talent beginning to make itself known."
He said, "Nah, you're wrong. Me? With a steamjack?" His mind was racing. Everything she said had struck a chord in him, and his entire being was resonating from the impact. He knew it was true, but how could it be? The very idea was ridiculous.
"It's not all about jacks," she said. "A person's arcane power always finds a way to express itself, but it's not always dramatic. You might be using arcane energy and not even know it. Sometimes it looks more like bending luck. So you move a little faster, jump a little higher."
She turned her face directly toward him, and he realized she was younger than he'd thought.
"Shoot a little straighter."
He swallowed.
"But to take full advantage of your talent, you need training. Training you can get with the resistance. You'd be able to study your power, practice, learn alongside someone more experienced."
"But I'd have to be part of the resistance," he said. She nodded. "Fighting for the old government?"
"No."
The vehemence in her voice startled Gaston.
"The old government betrayed us. We can never forget that. What we fight for now is the chance for a new government, a truly free Lael."
He shook his head.
"Call it what you want, it's all the same." "No. 1,000 times, no. I won't lift a finger to help reinstate the filthy rats who misuse their own people. Let them rot for all I care." "You'd pass up Warcaster training out of spite? You have that much hate in you?"
she asked. She sounded genuinely surprised, and for a split second, Gaston felt bad. He said, "If I do have this Warcaster thing, this ability, I'll figure it out on my own. Like I've done everything my whole life. I don't need your help, and I won't answer to anyone, especially the resistance."
The woman stood up. "Don't miss this chance, Gaston," she said. What a waste that would be.
She walked to the door, but turned back before opening it.
Your opportunities are not limitless. You need to see the value of this offer before it's too late.
And then she was gone. The man Wall gave him back his knives and ammunition and left as well. When Gaston opened the door, the red-haired woman was waiting for him.
How did it go? She asked.
Your people are sure persistent, said Gaston, but that lady is crazy.
You're not the first to say so, she laughed. But she's leaving soon.
She grabbed his arm and spoke urgently into his ear.
You know the old singing starling building near Crystal Park? 6 days from now, an hour after dusk. Be there, or she leaves without you.
She let go of his arm and melted into the crowd.
I've got most of it worked out.
Fitch pulled Gaston into the shadows. The narrow alley was deserted, but he looked around and lowered his voice anyway.
Gaston, this is our chance. Just one hit and we'll both be set for life. Since when did you lose your spine?
Gaston shook his head.
It's just not possible for one man. Nobody could get a hold of the gold boat shipment on their own. Not even me. So what about with the crew? Not just sneak thieves, but the fastest and smartest. I can make that happen. I know some of the best in the city, Gaston. They follow you, and with a good plan, we could do this.
Gaston stared at Fitch. When had he gotten so bold? How did he know the city's best thieves? What had the boy been up to? I work alone, he said. I won't have the lives of a bunch of hoodlums on my head. He started to walk away.
I can get us onto the delivery wagon, Fitch said.
Gaston stopped and turned around slowly. You can what? He said.
The delivery wagon that takes the gold boat shipment to the Cape Dorin warehouse. I can get us on as driver and second.
He waved away the question Gaston was about to ask.
I've made a lot of new friends since you've been busy with other things. For a cut of the take, a certain wagoner is willing to come down with a bad stomach. He'll have to call in replacements. Us.
The boy was flushed with pride, Gaston noticed, but he kept his voice even. Interesting, Gaston admitted, but I don't know if it's enough. I'll have to think about it. Fitch nodded.
Think fast, he said. The shipment's due in port before week's end, and we need a plan.
With a thrill, Gaston realized if he pulled this off, word might reach the hooded resistance recruiter before she left the city. Then she and everyone else would know how wrong they were to think he was at the mercy of the Cadorans. He could take care of himself. The dust that grayed Gaston's hair made his eyes water, and the false mustache and goatee he'd affixed to his dirty face itched. He kept his composure, though, focusing on the day's plan.
Here we go,
he said under his breath as he pulled the wagon up to the checkpoint. A sullen-looking guardsman approached.
Names, said the guardsman.
Henri Leblanc and Hugh Rossignol, with Dupre's conveyance, said Gaston, holding up a weathered parchment. The guardsman glanced at it but didn't take it.
What are you carrying?
Gaston smiled thinly. Nothing but rope and tarps for now, he said. But I'll be back through later with blessings from afar. The gold boat's in, thank Morrow, and I'm to bring in the shipment. The guardsman grunted and stepped back, waving the wagon through. Beside Gaston, Fitch let out a breath in relief. Gaston glanced at him.
You okay?
Not getting nervous, are you? The boy smiled.
I can't believe how easy that was.
Gaston set his teeth. Fool had better not screw this up, he thought. I don't think I'd like the view from the Queen's Gate. When they approached the docks, they passed through another checkpoint, this one more heavily guarded with a mix of Cadoran soldiers and Meriwyn City Guard. As before, the parchment Gaston held up seemed to be satisfactory, and they were allowed to pass. Gaston oversaw the loading of the goods onto the wagon, which was watched over by a half dozen of the City Guard. Climbing around in the bed of the wagon, Fitch saw that each crate, box, and barrel was positioned to spread the weight of the load across the wagon bed. Once that work was done,
He tied down the tarp and clambered back onto the bench. The captain had Gaston make his mark on a register and then handed him a sheaf of heavy cream-colored papers closed with a heavy wax seal of red to deliver to the warehouse manager. Gaston stowed the papers and joined Fitch on the wagon's bench. Four guards on horseback approached, three city guard and a Cadoran sergeant. After a brief exchange with the capitan, the sergeant called, "Head out!" Gaston flicked the reins, and the procession began to move. One stage down, Gaston thought. Morrow willing, they all go as smoothly. The loaded wagon moved steadily north along Kingfisher Road, which curved from the docks to the center of the city roughly along the same line as the canal that lay not far to the west. They made good time toward the central warehouse of the Cadoran army, and the guards had relaxed somewhat once they had passed through the wooded area northeast of the checkpoint to the inner city. The chances of trouble were lower within this more protected ring, even with the numerous buildings, side streets, and alleys that lined the road as they approached the center of Meriwen. The Cadorans had taken over many of the nicer estates in this part of the city as barracks, and indications of their presence were everywhere. At one point, the guards stopped the wagon at an intersection, and Gaston had to concentrate to keep his expression impassive as an entire company of Winter Guard marched past in formation. They were just rounding the upper bend, where the Kingfisher began to curve northwest, when one of the guards, a snub-nosed woman with straw-colored hair, presumably saw something ahead and kicked her horse into a gallop. Gaston shared a look with Fitch and shrugged. "Don't worry, boy," he said loud enough for the sergeant alongside them to hear. "The guards will make sure we're safe as a babe in his cradle." Fitch turned red and glowered at him, and out of the corner of his eye Gaston saw the Cadoran's half-smile. He had to suppress a smile himself. After a moment, the guard returned and reported, "There's a farm wagon overturned ahead. Fools blocking the road." The sergeant frowned. "What's this load?"
"Looks like soil," she answered. "It's spilled across the whole road."
"How many with him?"
"Just one, I could see. Nothing else."
The sergeant nodded and turned to the rear guards. "Could be an ambush. Keep your eyes and ears open." They nodded.
After a few moments, the group rounded the bend, and the wagon came into view. A tall, thin woman was calming the unhitched horse, while the farmer tried to right the wagon. Soil was spilled out across the road. The sergeant held up a hand, and Gaston brought their wagon to a stop. Then the wind shifted, and the truth hit them square in the face. That wasn't soil, it was manure, and unbelievably ripe. Gaston, Fitch, and all four guards gasped and coughed, eyes watering with the sudden stench of it. It was one thing to encounter that smell on a farm or in the stables, but to suddenly be engulfed in it in the open was something else, or so they assumed. Gaston knew the alchemical concoction added to the load made the fumes burn their eyes and irritate their throats. Next to Gaston, Fitch swallowed, his skin ashen.
"Henri, I don't feel so good," he said, his pale face twisted miserably.
Gaston said, "Settle down, boy, you'll be fine." The Cadoran sergeant only glanced at them.
The farmer saw the approaching group and stood upright to wipe his brow. He came forward then, waving the sweaty cloth in the air as though to flag them down.
"Morrow be praised. Come to do a good turn? First job I've had in 2 months, this and the mare upset by a wasp and a rut in the road. Don't know what I'd have done if you hadn't come along."
"Apologies," called the sergeant, "but we're on city business and cannot stop. Move aside, and I'll send someone back to check on you soon enough."
On the wagon bench, Fitch looked up piteously.
"No, really, I think I'm going to..."
He practically threw himself off the wagon to vomit spectacularly onto the road. The guard on his side quickly moved her horse forward, her face showing disgust even as she returned to scanning the upper windows and roofs of the nearby buildings for threats. The farmer answered,
"City business, of course, but how do I move aside exactly?" He spread his arms to indicate the toppled wagon and its spilled load.
Now, if I had some help, I'm sure we could get this wagon up in the swish of a nag's tail.
The sergeant glanced at the surrounding buildings. Gaston spoke up.
Begging your pardon, but we could backtrack a bit and go around by way of the Midnight Road and then the Lady's Fingers. It would take longer, but...
He pointed his chin at the load of manure, disgust clearly on his face. The Cadoran grunted and looked at him with narrowed eyes. The Midnight Road was known for being dark whatever the time of day because of the surrounding buildings, hills, and trees. Gaston knew no guard who valued his skin would willingly take the gold boat shipment that way, and the Lady's Fingers were a lattice of short streets that crisscrossed through several questionable neighborhoods and which would be difficult to navigate with a loaded weapon. Given those options, he knew which choice he would make. The sergeant turned to the two rear guards.
Rowan, Lazarus, give the fellow a hand and be quick about it. We have a schedule to keep.
The two men looked surprised, but immediately dismounted and moved to assist the farmer, taking care not to step in the mess Fitch had made. Gaston said loudly,
If you're done there, Hugh, come lie down below the bench. Wouldn't do to get left behind.
Nodding, Fitch pushed himself up from the ground, spat, and climbed clumsily back up onto the wagon, then disappeared below the bench. Gaston cursed, loudly enough for the guards to hear.
Damn fool boy! See if you get your day's wages after this!
He kept up the grumbling until he judged enough time had passed for Fitch to be in place within the wagon. The modifications he had made to it were about to be put to use. Together, the two guards and the farmer had almost righted the overturned wagon, though the guards were coughing and sputtering. Gaston assumed an impatient expression and began tapping his boot on the floorboards. Just as the men managed to heave the farmer's wagon to its wheels, he stopped. That was the signal. He couldn't hear anything over the commotion, of course, but he felt the slight shudder in the wagon as the oiled mechanism he'd installed was engaged to lower a portion of the wagon bed onto the street. He smiled at the sergeant when the man looked his direction, but the Cadoran moved his horse closer to the obstructing wagon and continued to throw glances up at the nearby buildings, more interested in getting back on the road than in anything else. Gaston could feel his heart beating fast in his chest and focused on maintaining a normal expression.
"Come on, fellows, let's see if you're worth what we're paying," he thought, willing himself not to look toward the back of the wagon.
He turned his head as he leaned to one side to pick something up off the floorboards. Adrenaline surged into his body when out of the corner of his eye he saw a shadowy figure dart from the nearest alley and slip under the wagon as quietly as a cat. A moment later, it emerged to slink back to the alley, moving more slowly with the burden of a crate. Another figure disappeared under the wagon and retreated with a large box. Gaston knew they'd be dropping the stolen boxes onto a handcart stashed in the alley. It would never hold the entire wagon's delivery, but he expected they'd only have time to transfer a handful of boxes anyway. Considering the contents of the boxes, even just a couple would be quite a haul. The two guards who had been assisting the farmer turned to make their way back to their mounts.
No, not yet, he thought.
His mind racing, Gaston stood and yelled at the woman leading the mare over to be hitched to the wagon.
Watch yourself, woman! The horse!
The woman screamed before he'd gotten out the words, and the mare reared, whinnying and pawing the air before landing. Trying to avoid the hooves, the woman pulled on the lead rope, but the horse continued to dance and toss her head, eyes rolling wildly, and then reared again. Both guards on horseback had to control their mounts, which stepped sideways nervously at the excitement. The two guards on foot ran over to assist with the mare. Gaston saw the first shadowy figure make another trip from the wagon and disappear into the alley. One of the guards finally caught the mare's bridle and began to calm her with gentle strokes and soothing words. The animal continued to move skittishly under his hand, but before too long, her eyes stopped rolling and her breathing returned to normal. The second shadowy figure made another trip from the wagon. The guard held the lead rope out to the woman, but she stepped back and shook her head, pretending to be frightened.
The man looked back to the farmer, who was shoveling manure, and then led the horse over and began to hitch her to the wagon. He felt the mechanism raising the platform back up the wagon, and a third shadow slunk from the wagon toward the alley. Fitch. Though Gaston had hoped to get a few more crates, he felt a moment of relief. They needed to get out of here, and he certainly wasn't wild about the idea of the hired crew being alone with the goods. They could have their share once everyone had made it back to the rendezvous point. The sergeant turned his horse back toward the supply wagon, and Gaston tensed. "Don't look," he thought, almost at the same time as, "Rot it, Fitch, I knew you'd screw this up." Then everything happened at once. The Cadoran's eyes narrowed, and he opened his mouth to call out an order, even as he shifted his weight to urge his mount forward. At the same moment, Gaston whipped the reins on his team, yelling, "Hia!" Startled, the horses bolted forward, and Gaston guided them straight toward the farmer's wagon. The sergeant pulled his mount hard to the side to avoid being trampled, cursing and shouting at his guards as he drew his pistol. The farmer's horse reared and danced. The second mounted guard kicked her horse to pursue the supply wagon and its valuable load. Two wheels of the vehicle tipped off the road into the soft mud, and Gaston felt the needle of panic that they would be mired, but he managed to careen past the manure wagon. From the corner of his eye, he saw no sign of the farmer or his assistant. He pulled his loaded quad iron from under the bench and leveled a shot toward the farmer's vehicle, hoping the man was smart enough to be down or well away. The wagon bed exploded with the impact of the bullet at such close range, pelting the area with manure and wood debris. The farmer's horse screamed and bolted, pulling the partially destroyed wagon behind it as it ran down the road. The two guards already after Gaston were only put off their stride for a moment, and then they were also past the wagon. He heard a pistol shot ring out and then rifle fire, and he crouched down as low as he could, thankful it was so difficult to shoot accurately from horseback. He barely had control of his wagon team, and they showed every sign of very much wanting to be back on the main road and far away from his oversized quad iron. He saw an ale cart coming his direction and nearly crashed into it before he could turn onto a small side street. He could barely hear the driver's curses over the din of the wagon barreling down the paved road. Risking a glance over his shoulder, he saw the two mounted guards make the turn much more easily than he had. They were gaining on him, and they still had their guns out. He'd drawn them as far away from the rest of the crew as he could. It was time to let them have their wagon back. Holstering his gun, Gaston glanced around quickly to take stock of the neighborhood. He knew most of the city well, and his illegal activities had honed his ability to read an area for bolt holes, likely caches, unlocked gates, and easily distracted residents. One of the mansions the Reds had taken over for officers' barracks wasn't far from here, though, which complicated matters even more. He could hardly afford to have Winter Guard involved as well. A shot hit his wagon, and he made his move. Still crouching low, he pulled the wagon closer to his side of the street and leapt off, launching himself into the shadow of an old two-story church. "Morrow, help me. This is as close to praying as I get," he thought as he hit the pavement. He rolled onto his feet and sprinted behind the church and across the property. He could hear hoofbeats, but only from one horse. The other guard had probably gone after the wagon. He darted behind a gaudy marble statue on a large pedestal, some noble's vanity gift, no doubt, flattened himself against the base, and waited for the rider to pass him. Would it be the sergeant? Or the second? He really hoped it wouldn't be the Cadoran. Either because they were stupid or because they were stubborn, those pig bastards could be as hard to lose as cold in winter. It was the Cadoran, damn it! He raced by, and Gaston peeked out, then dashed across the alley to the house across from the church, one of a row of houses that crowded the next street all the way up to where it crossed Hyacinth, about a mile to the north. The houses in this neighborhood had once been known for their climbing vines and flowers, and he knew this one still had a trellis. He clambered up it quickly. Once on the roof, Gaston allowed himself a moment to catch his breath before picking his way to the side edge, where the next house practically butted up against this one. He made the short jump, crossed that roof, and leapt to the third roof the same way. There he paused, listening for the Cadoran's horse, but he couldn't hear anything. His blood ran cold, and he made his way to the back of the roof, where it looked down on the alley. Gaston peered over the edge of the roof and froze in horror. The rotted Cadoran was right there under his nose, holding his horse still as he looked around the alley. Gaston stared at the top of the man's stupid hat, hating him with every part of his being. The guard suddenly tensed. Gaston sucked in a breath and pulled back slowly so as not to draw attention if the man happened to glance upward. With a start, he realized his hand was on the handle of his holstered quad iron, though he didn't remember moving it there. He pulled it away and focused on his breathing for a moment. When he checked the alley again, the Cadoran had moved on. Gaston looked up the alley toward the retreating guard, feeling pleased with himself. "Looks like my luck is holding," he thought. The gambler took the last bite of the bland soup, dropped the spoon into the wooden bowl, and sat back in his chair. Miller beans weren't his favorite by far, but he'd found that a poor meal was often the price for good information. From where he sat near the fireplace, he had a decent view of the other customers, and he'd been listening to a group of young people getting into their cups at a nearby table.
"He hit Le Fontaine's, did you hear? Got a silver service worth a year's wages,"
said a youth with light hair and bleary eyes. He had a well-worn pamphlet in his hands, a resistance pamphlet, judging by the way he folded and unfolded it nervously. Another, a pale girl with a shock of black curls, shook her head.
"I heard he got more than that. One of the paintings is missing."
"Why steal a painting?" said another boy, also with black curls. "What's the point? Nobody would touch the thing."
From where he sat, the gambler said,
"He must have connections with better taste than you."
All three of their heads swiveled to face him. He chuckled, picked up his mug, and moved to their table.
"Why else would he bother? To hang it in his foyer?"
He laughed, and the others joined in. The pale-haired boy jammed the pamphlet in his pocket. The man waved to the serving boy and pulled out a chair for himself.
"Bring me another," he said to the boy when he arrived. "No, bring us a pitcher."
The young people smiled and elbowed each other. The gambler pretended to study his ale.
What a feat, though. Who could do such a thing and right under the Cadoran's noses? Nobody, I tell you. Not without getting caught.
"Nobody except Gaston Cross,"
cried the light-haired boy. The others nodded, grinning. Clearly the thief's talents could not be questioned here.
"Gaston Cross,"
the gambler repeated in a half-whisper.
"Gaston!"
cried the black-haired boy, mistaking his contemplation for a toast and raising a half-empty mug. The others followed suit. The serving boy returned with their pitcher, and the gambler sat back and let the others fill their mugs. Under the table, he repeatedly turned over a stone in his left hand, feeling its roughly polished edges against his fingers. One of his men had given it to him after a kid had offered it as part of a payment for a gambling debt. The idiot lieutenant had thought it worthless, or else he might never have turned it over. It was, in fact, quite valuable to the gambler, but not for the coin it could bring. He had other stones just like it, thanks to the thieving wretch who'd taken Gypsy Kiss. Gaston Cross. Something was off. Gaston could feel it. From a shadowy corner, he watched the side door to the small warehouse, just as he'd been doing for the last half hour. There was no sign of anything unusual, but he couldn't shake the itchy feeling something was very wrong. Finally, he steeled his nerve and made his way to the door, careful to stay in the late afternoon shadow of the buildings. He kept his senses alert for anything that might indicate the plan had gone sour, but there was nothing. That in and of itself made him nervous. Since when did nothing go wrong for him? Not that he didn't always manage to land on his feet, he did, every time, but so far this job had gone reasonably well, and That made him wonder what was coming. He peered in through the small windows of the warehouse, hoping to see Fitch's crew inside waiting. They should be happy, perhaps celebrating with just a nip from a stowed bottle of usk or ale. If those idiots are drunk, he thought. But he never finished the sentence. He could see the warehouse was empty. How was it possible no one had made it back here yet? Even with the goods to carry, they should have arrived before him. Gaston heard a distant rhythmic pounding growing louder and realized it was the sound of an approaching guard patrol. Pigs and piss! When had they changed their patrol pattern? Unless... He darted to the side door only to find it locked. Fitch was supposed to have it open by now. Thomar, take that rotted boy, he thought. If he so much as considered double-crossing me, I swear I'll end him even if I have to do it from jail. The footsteps continued to grow louder. The patrol couldn't be more than a street or two away now. Gaston realized he'd have to make a run for it. He knew Fitch's bolt holes and hiding places as well as he knew his own. He'd look for him in the perfumed quarters once something else had captured the guard's attention. Dirty weasel will just gamble away whatever money he's been paid for my head, Gaston thought. Casting one last glance toward the sound of approaching footsteps, Gaston broke into a run, making his coat fly. With every step, he could feel the guards close on his heels. Gaston skidded to a stop around the corner from Di Fiscani's shop and peeked around the edge of the building, breathing heavily. As usual, for the afternoon of a fine day, the street was filled with the buzz and bustle of a good number of people, Lely's citizens and Cadoran soldiers alike, going about their business. He pulled up the hood of his long coat and blended into the foot traffic. He kept his eye on the shop door, but no one entered or left. The shop seemed empty. The knot in his stomach tightened. It was definitely odd for Tante to close up in the middle of the day. She could be in the living quarters, though, trying to talk Fitch into coming clean with him, trying to figure out how to keep the kid from throwing his whole life away over money. He approached the shop, glanced around, and quickly slipped inside. He'd better not have drawn the guard down here, he thought. Seeing no signs in the shop of either Fitch or Tante, he continued on through the door to the apartments. He took care to step quietly, just in case. The living quarters were also empty, and the only item of interest he found, stuffed in Fitch's clothes chest, was a pamphlet like the one the red-haired woman had tried to give him on the street. Fitch? Interested in the resistance? He thought. I can't see it. There was no sign Fitch had been back, with or without the goods. This should have been reassuring, but Gaston couldn't quite dispel the cold dread that had grown in his chest over the afternoon. Something was wrong. He slipped back through the shop and into the street. Where would Fitch have gone? Maybe, just maybe, he'd been stupid enough to go back to the wagoners, and Tante had simply gone for supplies. Gaston made his way toward the end of the street, letting the crowd carry him forward. He eyed the nearby shops, wishing he could risk asking if anyone had seen the woman today. But he knew it was a risk he couldn't afford, not for himself or Tante. He clenched his teeth and pressed onward. "Captain!" called the woman's voice. Gaston had barely registered the meaning of the shouted word when he saw a woman in the uniform of the city guard bearing down on him through the crowd. He turned to run and saw another pair of guardsmen closing from behind. The nearest alley was a good ways ahead, and as the people realized what was happening, they retreated from the street to crowd along the edges, blocking any way out. "Hold guard!" It was Enzo, making his way from farther back. He shouted to the guardsmen who had first spotted Gaston. "Lassette, dammit! I said hold!" The woman stopped, but she kept her eyes fixed on Gaston and her hand on the cudgel at her belt. Gaston adopted a look of mild annoyance, as he had done nothing to deserve this sort of attention. He didn't see Fitch with the guard, so he didn't think the little punk had sold him out to them, but he couldn't be sure yet. He kept his eyes forward, but took in every detail of the street layout and the crowd with his peripheral vision, hoping for a chance to bolt. "Gaston,"
You need to come with me, Captain Enzo said, loud enough to be heard from 20 paces away.
What? Why? Never mind, it doesn't matter. I'm not going anywhere with these brutes.
He pointed a thumb at the guard around him. Enzo's mouth tightened.
Let's not do this out in the street. Cooperate, will you?
Gaston felt panic creeping into his throat.
I don't know what you're talking about. Go bother someone else. Find someone to throw in jail for stealing a crust of bread. I'm sure that